podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello, I'm Kate Moses, and it's my pleasure tonight to welcome you to the Lannan series of readings and conversations and to introduce Laurie Moore, whose short stories and novels are among the most perceptive, funny, and heartbreaking fictions being written in America today. I'd like to offer my thanks to the Lannan Foundation for their continued commitment to creating this forum for original thought-provoking voices like Laurie's, and for making this ongoing series available to an even wider audience through their website. Laurie Moore, yes, thank you. Laurie Moore has been called the nearest thing we have to Chekhov, and even a brief side-by-side consideration of these two masters of the short story shows the justice of the comparison. Novelist and critic James Lasden recently wrote that Chekhov's fictions gave us a reflection of ourselves in our unadorned ordinariness as well as our unfathomable strangeness, that his stories seemed to mirror the casual movement of reality itself. Chekhov was constantly drawn to the world's comic variousness, its oddity and humor, and the characteristic Chekhovian note was an unexpected harmony of the tragic and the farcical, the lyrical and the prosaic, the tender and the grotesque. In Chekhov, happiness almost always occurs against an encroaching darkness that requires constant warding off. You can't help but hear the echo of Chekhov's imaginative armory, as Lasden termed it, in the praise lavished upon the fictions of Laurie Moore. "She is a wicked observer," wrote The Guardian recently, "who relishes the cracks in mundane reality through which all kinds of bizarre madness can flourish." The New York Times has said that Ms. Moore gives us stark, melancholy glimpses into her characters' hearts, mapping their fears and disappointments, their hidden yearnings, and their more evanescent efforts to hold on to their dreams in the face of unfurling misfortune. Salon notes that her comedy bubbles up the way it does so often in life, through discomfort, tragedy, awkwardness, and loss. And her hallmark, says The Believer, has become the inextricability of humor and pathos, which she explores with rare understanding. Her characters observed with such generosity and insight that we're returned to our own lives crushed, revived, often laughing, and always deeply moved. It's those characters of Laurie's that stagger you when you read her. Characters whose quirks and gestures and devastating truth you can't quite shake when their stories are over. People who assume they've been cast in the lead role in the drama of their own lives, but when they get on the stage, sometimes find they're in the ensemble, or it's a different show entirely, or they're suddenly playing a part they are pretty sure wasn't written into their copy of the script. Whatever it is they're doing, taking their cat to the vet for a flea dip or bumming a smoke from a coworker at the amusement park while still wearing the Cinderella costume, or helplessly submitting to a pelvic exam in front of an entire class of medical students, or calculating their ambivalence about dating a lawyer named Pinky, you feel them quivering with imperfections and fragile hopes, often making their own mercilessly sharp and funny observations, as palpably real as the person sitting next to you now, crinkling his program. Growing up in Glens Falls, New York, a small town in the Adirondacks, Laurie had a childhood full of books and music and ballet lessons and art projects, and her parents belonged to an amateur operetta club. They put on plays and musicals, and on Sunday afternoons, from the time she was 3 or 4, Laurie was taken to the theater to watch the rehearsals, watching grown-ups she knew shed their everyday selves and fall in and out of characters, bursting into song or laughter, becoming someone or something else. "I would sit there," she says, "fantastically engaged, gripped, really, while someone who was ordinarily the postman or the office manager at GE came out and danced something wild from the pajama game." Looking back, I now suspect that That bit of early theater going is still at the heart of what I think is interesting and powerful narratively. That condition, however thrilling, of forever being in the audience is part of the pulse of everything I've written. By the time Laurie started college, she was too tall for ballet, and though at first she thought she'd be a painter, she realized she couldn't get the paint to do what she wanted it to. She played piano and loved to sing, but when she auditioned for the choir and didn't get in, she says, "I had to face facts. In so many things I loved, I was sadly insufficiently gifted and driven. But writing, I could plod along with. People were much kinder. I headed toward the kindness." After college, she lived in New York for a couple of years, working as a paralegal, whittling voluminous depositions of extraneous words. She says eventually they were just nouns. There was nothing but nouns. She began the MFA program in creative writing at Cornell with a self-imposed deadline for getting a book published by the time she was 30, or she'd give up and do something practical. So, of course, by the time she was 26, she'd sold her first book to Knopf, the short story collection Self-Help, which was published to a burst of acclaim. A year after Self-Help came her first novel, Anagrams, followed by her second story collection, Like Life, a story from which was selected by John Updike for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories of the Century. The publication of her second novel, Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, was met by the New York Times assessment that Laurie Moore may be the most acute and lasting writer of her generation. Her fifth book, Birds of America, was heralded by the appearance in The New Yorker of one of its short stories, which has since become as canonical to American contemporary fiction as the word in its subtitle. People like that are the only people here. Canonical babbling in Peed Ankh, a story about the impossibility of telling a story, of a couple whose baby is diagnosed with kidney cancer after the mother finds a blood clot in the baby's diaper. No one who has read the first paragraph of this story could ever forget Laurie Moore's description of the fictional moment of discovery. So what is this thing startling against the white diaper, like a tiny mouse heart packed in snow? Laurie holds the Delmore Schwartz Professorship in the Humanities at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where she's taught English and creative writing for over two decades. She's been included in several annual volumes of Best American Short Stories and is the recipient of several O. Henry Awards, the Irish Times International Prize for Fiction, the Penn Malamud Award, a Lannan Fellowship, and the Rhea Award for the Short Story for Outstanding Achievement in the Genre. In 2006, she was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And her sixth book, the novel A Gate at the Stairs, published just over a year ago, became a New York Times bestseller and was shortlisted for the prestigious Orange Prize. It's Laurie's most sweeping, sustained, and complex work to date, about a year in the life of a 20-year-old college student who takes a babysitting job with a couple who adopt a biracial toddler in the months after September 11th, as the U.S. is gearing up for war in the Middle East. On another level, though, A Gate at the Stairs is a kind of macrocosmic view of all the human foibles that Laurie Moore has illuminated so deftly and with such heart in the microcosms of her short stories and in her earlier novels. Like all of her books, A Gate at the Stairs will have you laughing out loud, cornering people to read passages to them, and then finding yourself blinking back tears, reading of how imperfectly we are loved and how inadequately we love in return, of the slipperiness of words and the consequences of carelessness, and how, in response, we try to imagine ourselves into lives we think we can live with. And finally, how, as best we can, we try to comfort ourselves and each other with humor and the smallest gestures of kindness, a testament to the necessity and the pleasure when it comes of connecting with other people, even when they and we are flawed. Please join me in welcoming Laurie Moore.
That's darling.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. One always feels rather foolish coming out on stage after an introduction like that, especially like that one. But it is so really nice to be here. Can you hear me? Yes, okay. Usually there's something I some protrusion I'm supposed to lean forward and read into. I once read into a reading light for 45 minutes. And no one could hear me at all, but they were all very polite. But now I've been wired up, so if you can't hear me, just shout out, and I think the sound people will fix it. I'm very honored to be invited by the Lannan Foundation to come here to this beautiful theater. If it weren't for the Lannan Foundation, I don't think I would have gotten any writing done in the last 10 years. So I really, my hat is off to them. I'm going to keep the reading a little on the short side, in honor of George O'Keefe, who agreed that less is more. In our house growing up, we used to say more is less. But also, I always think people come to readings not really to hear the reading. They're there for the Q&A, and they're there to check out the writer's shoes and earrings. And as you can see, I wore turquoise earrings, which must really thrill you Santa Fe residents. Just what a deep thrill to see turquoise, huh? But in Wisconsin, it's very exciting, these earrings. I get a lot of compliments in Wisconsin. Here, nothing. But we can talk about my shoes, and then we can do Kate afterward. I'm going to read from my novel, A Gate at the Stairs. It's told from the vantage point of a young woman who's probably, I don't know, maybe 30, maybe 29, but she's talking about the year that she was 20 and all the really unexpected things that happened to her during that year. She's a college student in the Midwest, and I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning, from the middle, and from the end, and I hope it doesn't spoil anything. I don't think it does. I don't think it spoils anything. So it's a bit of a collage. And what else should I tell you? Her name is Tassie Kalchin, and she's looking for a job that she ends up getting, but she's mostly a university student who has this part-time job. And the story that she ends up telling as an adult looking back is very much, I suppose, what you would expect when someone looks back at their life. What do they find? They find love. They find death. So this beginning part has a little bit of both. The middle part has the love part. And then there's death at the end. Okay? I'm going to have to take my glasses off to read, I think, actually. I was looking in December for work that would begin at the start of the January term. I'd finished my exams and was answering ads from the student job board, ones for child care provider. I liked children. I did. Or rather, I liked them okay. They were sometimes interesting. I admired their stamina and candor. And I was good with them in that I could make funny faces at the babies and with the older children, teach them card tricks and speak in the theatrically sarcastic tones that disarmed and enthralled them. But I was not especially skilled at minding children for long spells. I grew bored, perhaps like my own mother. After I spent too much time playing their games, my mind grew peckish and longed to lose itself in some book I had in my backpack. I was ever hopeful of early bedtimes and long naps. I'd come from Delacrosse Central High, from a small farm on the old Perryville Road, to this university town of Troy, the Athens of the Midwest. Oh, someone laughed. I caught the joke. Thank you. I was so proud of that joke when I wrote that, but not very many people get it. The university town of Troy, the Athens of the Midwest, she repeats terribly. As if from a cave, like the priest child of a Colombian tribe I'd read about in cultural anthropology, a boy made mystical by being kept in the dark for the bulk of his childhood and allowed only stories, no experience of the outside world. Once brought out into light, he would be in a perpetual, holy condition of bedazzlement and wonder. No story would ever have been equal to the thing itself. And so it was with me. Nothing had really prepared me. Not the college piggy bank in the dining room, the savings bonds from my grandparents, or the used set of World Book encyclopedias with their beautiful color charts of international wheat production and photographs of presidential birthplaces. The flat green world of my parents' hogless, horseless farm, its dullness, its flies, its quiet ripped open daily by the fumes and whining of machinery, twisted away and left me with a brilliant city life of books and films and witty friends. Someone had turned on the lights. Someone had led me out of the cave of Perryville Road. My brain was on fire with Chaucer, Sylvia Plath, Simone de Beauvoir. Twice a week, a young professor named Thad, dressed in jeans and a tie, stood before a lecture hall of stunned farm kids like me and spoke thrillingly of Henry James's masturbation of the comma. I was riveted. I had never before seen a man wear jeans with a tie. The ancient cave, of course, had produced a mystic. My childhood had produced only me. In the corridors, students argued over Bach, Beck, balkanization, bacterial warfare. Out-of-state kids said things to me like, "You're from the country. Is it true that if you eat a bear's liver, you'll die?" They asked, "Ever know someone who did you-know-what with a cow?" Or, they asked, "Is it an actual fact that pigs won't eat bananas?" What I did know was that a goat will not really consume a tin can. A goat just liked to lick the paste on the label. But no one ever asked me that. And now I'm going to the middle part, the love part. In Sufism class, I continued to sit next to the Brazilian. "What the hell is this prof saying?" he wrote to me on a notepad. "He's actually very smart," I murmured back. "He's talking about the four stages of the Torica and their rituals. There's a lot of piety, renunciation, and yearning for paradise." Then he leaned toward me and whispered, "I can see you don't join that easily in complaining. That's a good quality. But so is joining easily." Walking out of the lecture hall, he said to me, "Did you know it's Blackbird Days? I Giorno della Merla?" "What is that?" "I've never heard of that," I said. He studied me for a moment. "It's a celebration of the white blackbird who has taken refuge in the chimney, which blackens him with soot. It celebrates the soot." "Interesting," I said. "It's Brazilian," he said. I nodded, my head filled with the renunciation of renunciation and a yearning for yearning. I began to dress for him, relying mostly on a new gray-brown sweater dress I had bought in a boutique downtown with my new wages, a store where the clerks were chicly eager to help and where each item of apparel was in a color called peat or pumice or some such word. There were subtleties of neutral hue I'd never encountered before. Pebble, pecan, portabella, peanut, platinum, porcelain, pigeon, parmesan. Pavement, parchment, pearl, and potato. There were brighter colors, too. One could recite them all like a jump rope rhyme. paprika, pinot, persimmon, pimento, pomegranate, pine, poplar, pistachio. When I was actually writing this, I was thinking it was like a Keith Moon drum solo. You know, that's how deluded writers get at their desk. Pistachio, peacock, petal pink, polar peach, pumpkin, pepper, plum, pineapple, periwinkle, peridot, primrose, palm, pea, poppy, puce. My new dress was in a shade called oyster, which was a lot like fig gray, I noticed, and which I called stick, since it was the color of a stick. Growing up far from the sea, what did I know of oysters? It was the same hue as a muddy russet potato before the potato was hosed off. I felt it made my eyes dark and my hair shine, but maybe the color appealed because, unlike so much else I owned, it was not a yellowish shade of green that threw itself in with the natural tinge of my teeth. On days I wore the dress along with my water bra, the Brazilian was friendlier. Soon, and after an unfortunate but not totally annihilating laundering, I was calling the dress shtick. Did the Brazilian not know these were not my real breasts? Or not really? Did guys even bother to want to know? Girls were walking around wearing these soft protrusions, and the guys were just going, do-de-do, like Homer Simpson. Perhaps when God said, let there be light, in the original and correct Bible still undiscovered, he also said, let there be do-de-do. Thank you, God. After class, the Brazilian and I would walk out together. He was tall and long-limbed beside me, and my walking close to him in matched stride with him made me feel in possession of a prize. One time we made it all the way to a coffee shop where I asked him whether he'd like to have coffee with me, and he said no. Oh, Coles to Newcastle and all that probably, I said, flustered. Why would a Brazilian drink coffee in America? Don't know what I was thinking. I turned to go. I'd like a Coke, though, he said. Okay, I said. They have Pepsi in there, is that all right? Okay, he said. He had a smile that made you realize that some skulls contained an entire power plant set up in miniature inside, and the heat and electricity they generated spilled their voltage out through the teeth and eyes. Teach me some Portuguese, I said, over coffee and cola at a back table near a table of zines and flyers. And what he taught me, phrases from little songs, I repeated and rehearsed at home. They could have been Etruscan for all I knew. Negro blanco, me gusta naranja. I learned much later it was actually Spanish, with some Italian thrown in. Except for the words to happy birthday, none of it was Portuguese at all. Thus began my protracted misunderstanding of romance languages. In high school, I had taken German with Frau Zinkraub. On the tops of all my quizzes, I drew pictures of panzer tanks with Hitler on top and a salute. I had tried Latin, but in situ there had been no one to speak it with, and so what was the point? I would do things like imagine ergonomic meant therefore-ish. Romance languages eluded me both generally and specifically. Nothing was as cryptic and ripe for misunderstanding as the physical language of a boy's love. What was an involuntary grimace, I took to be rapture. What was a simple, natural, masculine compulsion to be in, to tunnel and thrust, I saw as a tender desire to be sweetly engulfed and at least momentarily overpowered by another's devoted attentions. What was an urgent, automatic back and forth of the body, I thought of as the eternal romantic return of the lover. Kissing was not animal appetite, but the heart flying up to the lips and speaking its unique attraction in keeping speaking its unique attraction in deep, eternal fondnesses in the only way it could. The juddering of climax, as involuntary as a death rattle, I took to be a statement of hopeless attachment. Why, I don't know. I didn't think of myself as sentimental or dumb. I thought of myself as spiritually alert. "Are you a virgin?" he had asked. "Yes," I said. That he couldn't tell already, that it wasn't spelled out all over my face and demeanor, thrilled me. To be funny, I rolled my head with a harlot's abandon and purred, "I am." I fell back the way a cooked onion slid apart in all its layers when bit. Later, I would come to believe that erotic ties were all a spell, a temporary psychosis, even a kind of violence, or at least they coexisted with these states. I noted that criminals, as well as the insane, tended to give off a palpable, vibrating allure, a kind of animal magnetism that kept them loved by someone. How else could they survive at all? Someone had to hide them from the authorities. Hence the necessity and prevalence of sex appeal for people who were wild and on the edge. If only I could have dated someone who was both insane and criminal. If only I could have dated the criminally insane, I could have doubled my fun and entered the purest, highest, exhilarating erotic and narcotic trance. And if I'd lived to tell the tale, perhaps come to my senses sooner. I was in a fused condition of ecstasy and retrospective rue almost always and from the beginning. "I love you," I would say. And he said nothing at all. But no shame rose in me to rescue or silence me. "I love you," I said again. And then I added, "Is there an echo in here?" "There is," he would say, smiling. His teeth were the color of cream, his gums the pale locks pink of a winter tomato. He wore, wrapped around his neck, a black and white scarf, a print I thought of as Middle Eastern, though it could have been a Navajo tablecloth for all I knew. "Yeah, I thought so," I said. I would tenderly smooth the strands of hair off my own face, myself. I had told my roommate Murph that I had a crush on a South American, and while I was out, she called from her boyfriend's one night and sang into the phone, "Pedro, Pedro, Bobedro, Banana, Fana, Fofedro, Fi, Fi, Momedro." And now we come to the last part. Life was unendurable, and yet everywhere it was endured. I was reliving my old homework from mythology for freshmen, the work of grief where only unsteady progress could be made, seemed at first Herculean, then Sisyphean, then Persian, then Echovian. Then one was turned finally and prematurely into a flower or a tree, with a flower's curvature and a tree's yearning reach, paralyzed but with shoes and dinner and chores. As the autumn weeks went by more and more, I left my room and began to help my father with the harvest, and sometimes even rode with him, taking the small roads along the drumlins and moraines to Chicago, delivering potatoes and our three-season spring mix to some restaurants, as well as occasionally setting up at the farmers' markets there. Certain moments, the whole earth seemed a grave. Other times, more hopefully, a garden. We would start off bright and early into the rising sun, the ground billowing up its dew in such heavy, magical vapors that when one was in the troughs of the highway, one couldn't see a foot ahead, and the fields looked as if they were on smoky fire, preparing for the visitation of ascending or descending gods. Which could it be? Perhaps it was true what people used to say about our county. Outer space was interested. but then the air would clear and the day would be awash in light. I studied the third cutting hay, rolled into tight coils on the fields and placed at perfect distances from one another, as if by an art department. One had to get on with life, out of good manners, if nothing else. My dad and I would strike up random conversation. Seahorses give birth, I would begin. But they're male. Why do we even call them male if they give birth? And my dad would be silent, driving, considering. Then he would speak. Because the seahorses insist on it, he said. They don't want what happened to ladybugs to happen to them. These ladybugs have masculinity issues to beat the band. I tried to laugh. I appreciated my dad's trying to acknowledge me, be with me, though it had become difficult for him. Ahead of us, ballooning clouds floated there absurdly, as if for a party that had yet to begin. Groups of geese crawled through the sky, their metallic honks declaring their departure south. We would stop somewhere to eat and do just and only that, stop and eat. We got BLTs and soup and then would continue on our way. The brilliant gold leaves and grasses, the drying roadside timothy and blue stem, all looked on a nice day like a hymn to sunlight. When in fact, if one actually thought seriously about the situation, the mechanism of their dialogue with the sun had been shed entirely. The honey locusts had gone first, raining shimmering trails of seedlings into the gutters of the streets and town. Then the yam and ham-hued maples, a papery caramel of leaves or trail of maize or both lined every road we were on. How like the end of love to leave a beautiful corpse. When they weren't gold against blue like something royal, the oaks bore the flat, blackish red of a blood orange, and my father and I would drive along, staring out at them through the windshield, each of us thinking our own thoughts. One evening, migrating songbirds, oriented toward the moon, mistook a red-lit cell phone tower for their destination, and we watched as they all shredded themselves in the tower's steel supports. More disastrous love performed in symbols. As we passed, my father slowed down, then sped up again. Silence was not the worst thing, though it still contained sorrow and making do. Here and there, a rabbit scurried across our path. Are rabbits nocturnal? I asked. Yep, he said. Well, if they're nocturnal, why do we see them in the day as well? My father was quiet for a long time. They work in shifts, he said finally. Fattening in the butt, shy, petty, carsick, except in a truck. Perhaps I was more suited to country life than I'd ever understood. When we got back at night, my father would slam the truck door and look at the vast and watchful sky. That's a hell of a heaven up there, he would say. That's the end of the death part. So. But I'll be back. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Just what are we doing? No wine, but...
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Kate.
My new best friend.
Now we get to analyze your outfit. Let's see your earrings.
Yeah. I wore them for the birds.
They're very complicated.
They're tiny little paintings of a bird.
Oh, they're gorgeous.
I don't know what they are.
You'll have to take them off and pass them.
I know. Well, but so you screwed me, Lori, because the whole reason I wore them was because of the first line of the book. And you started on what? Like the third line.
I still had birds. I had those birds zipping through those cell phone towers.
So, but their friends, their brethren in the beginning of the book were the songbirds who'd gotten confused. They'd been caught off guard and they didn't leave early enough.
Birds are writers love birds because not only do they sing, But they get confused a lot.
Yeah.
And so they're vulnerable, and they're on the decline. So writers just love birds.
Yeah, well, that was one of those things that I think you didn't understand until you were almost done with Birds of America, that you had birds in every single story.
I did, and then I thought, yeah, I had birds in every single story. But then I probably had birds in every other story of my other collections as well and didn't notice. But I noticed it that time, and I noticed it also in conjunction with a comment that Stephen Sondheim had made, that the use of bird imagery is a sign of a second-rate poet. I thought, uh-oh. Because he was a protege of Oscar Hammerstein, who used birds all the time, even more than I, and really absurdly. You know, well, to sing through the night like a lark that is learning to pray. Okay. A lark that is learning to pray. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's such a great line.
Well, it's beautiful as it hits those notes.
Yeah.
But it's absurd.
Right. And I think you also told the story at one point that, well, there's a scene in one of the stories in Birds in America where a couple have taken a road trip and they go to see what they think is Audubon's house in Key West, the Audubon Museum, and they get there and they find out, well, it's not really Audubon's house. He lived here for a while he was shooting the birds that he would then, you know, he kills the birds and then he paints them. So, which was, you know, equivalent to
being a writer. Yeah. Being a writer, I thought it was a metaphor for art.
Right, exactly.
Right. Shoot them, stuff them,
yeah.
Then turn it into art.
Please hold still while I get a description of you down.
Right.
So I was wondering while you were reading, do you sit at your desk and one of two things, or both things. One, do you just crack yourself up with the things that your characters come up with all the time?
I don't think so. I mean, sometimes I obviously, you know, you have to find something amusing. I mean, if there's a little funny moment, you have to find it amusing. But usually I've thought about it so far in advance, by the time that I write it, I'm thinking, no one's going to find this funny. So if anyone does find it funny, I end up being very grateful.
Well, this reminds me of one scene that I did read out loud to my kids a couple of weeks ago. It's the story is called Willing. I think that's in Birds in America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about this actress, you know, sort of like not a big star and maybe her
career.
No,
she's a washed out.
Yeah, and
starlet.
So she goes to live in Chicago and she starts dating this inappropriate man. And at one point they're talking and she doesn't have kids, he doesn't have kids. And she said, I always... Well, why am I telling you? You wrote it. Do you remember?
I don't remember. You'll have to...
She said, well, I always hoped to have a daughter, and I would name her after my grandmother. And he said, what was your grandmother's name? And she said, Grandma. So my 14-year-old is going around, like, the internet is... Tumblr is on fire with your joke about Grandma.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Now everybody knows.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought it was amusing at the time, but that was a long time ago.
That was pretty funny. Well, do you... The other question I had about when you're at home working is, do you read your work out loud?
I don't. And... it's interesting because the last reading I gave was with John Franzen, and he's adamant about reading his work out loud. He reads it out loud all the time, and he's a terrific reader.
While he's working.
But while he's working, it's very important to him to read it out loud. And I feel there's some other kind of voice that is not the voice of me reading it out loud that I want the reader to hear, that I won't be able to recreate it. So why bother reading it out loud?
Right.
I feel that silently it has to somehow get to your mind's ear and register there. So the reading out loud part, I think, can be, for me at any rate, just a little distorting. I know that many writers really say you should read things mm-hmm. out loud, and
yeah,
they believe their students should. And there's something, there are some things that you can learn from that, but what you really do learn when you read something that you've written out loud is the difference between the voice on the page and the voice in the room. And when you write something on a page, publish a book, send it out in the world, that's the voice on the page, and it's not the voice in the room. Right. What you're sending out into the world is the voice on the page, which is a little different.
Right.
So.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed reading your work and also hearing you read it aloud is there's so much music in your work, you know, just like birds. There's music in every story. There's music all over the novels. And sometimes it's actual music. It's a song or, you know, someone's singing or wants to sing or, you know, they quote song lyrics or...
Or they make the song lyrics up. I had a lot of fun doing that.
Well, that's Tassie does that.
Right. The main character of this novel writes these really bad songs. And for some reason, I really cared a lot about these songs. And when I sent the book into my agent and she phoned and to say, you know, give me her response, I kept listening, and she didn't say anything about the songs. I said, well, did you like Tassie's songs? Those stupid songs, did you like them? And she said, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah. You know, she could hardly remember them.
But they're great, you know. They're
just really
like,
silly. They're very silly.
They're silly, and they're full of, you know, the Gate at the Stairs song is particularly wonderful. You know,
I like that song, yeah.
Which is one of the ways that A Gate at the Stairs comes up in the book. It comes up in many, many ways. There's, well, in fact, in your reading, you didn't
hit any of them, I don't think.
talk about that one, the surface story about Tassie going, well, you said she's going to get a job. She needs a job to have basically pocket money while she's at school. And so she gets a job as a babysitter for this couple, actually before the couple have adopted a baby. And it's coming up their stairs or coming in their yard. They have a gate that's broken in their front yard. But there are also gates all through the book. There are the gates in the songs. There's the gate that the mother of the adopted baby is named Sarah. There's a point when they're going to see a prospective birth mother and baby, and they're at an airport. And when they're at the airline gate, Sarah runs up the down staircase, which is
bizarre.
Bizarre and so telling of her character.
Of what's to come.
She's someone who's running up the down staircase all over the place.
Well, there are a lot of gates. There's a gate on the farm. Did you mention that gate on the farm?
No, and the gate on the farm.
There's a gate on the farm as well.
Pound.
The first gate that comes up, you know, one of the things I wanted to do with this book was to collect all the things that I thought were interesting about the Midwest and things that I had noticed when I had first moved there years and years ago. And one of the things that I noticed that all these fences and gates were qualine fence. And so I...
What is a qualine fence?
Interesting you should ask.
And I need to know what Grandma Jello is, too.
Yeah, well, they're both Wisconsin things. And qualine fence was so entrenched in my idea of what Wisconsin is, I forgot that it was an actual company. And so when the book came out, I got a letter from the head of Qualine Fence who was concerned that the broken gate at the beginning happened to be their fence. And if it was based on any fence that I actually owned, they volunteered to come and fix it.
Is this, you know, is that sort of like the Wisconsin personality, do you think? Like they would write you a letter and offer to fix it, or were they really saying you jerk?
They didn't know. No, they were polite. They were just weren't. They were baffled to find themselves in there. I also got another letter from somebody, because there's a character in the book who is doing eye research, and it's about the effects of red wine on eye cancer, there's only one study of this kind in the world, and it's in Madison. And so this man who headed up the study was reading my book only to discover this villainous, awful character was doing his research. And so but then he got nervous because he thought, well, how does she know anything about our research? And are there other scientists doing our research around in the world? I should write her and let her, you know, to find out. So he wrote me, very nice man. And I said, oh, no, I think I don't know of any other group of scientists doing this research, not to worry.
And you're the only one. And you didn't hide it anagrammatically somewhere in the book?
No, I just heard it at some dinner party. Somebody was, you know, somebody was doing this, and I thought, oh, that's a good kind of medical research. Because I wanted this kind of awful character to have some redeeming qualities.
Right.
And cancer research would be a nice thing for him to do, compensate.
To compensate for your description of his hair that looks like a hair cape. Because it's, you know, he's balding on the top and then it's just long in the back and curly.
That may be what the scientists objected to, the description
of
the hair.
He really didn't want anyone to think, oh, there's that scientist doing the eye research who's got a hair cape. Well, when you started, did you have a sense of where you wanted this book to go? Did you have a sense of Tassie first, or the time first, or, you know, where did you start with this?
I had a sense of Tassie, and I had a sense that I wanted to capture the sort of contemporary Midwest, which I felt was quite different from people's preconceptions, that mm-hmm. that there are things happening there, occurring there, that the rest of, you know, the sophisticated coast might not, you know, realize. And so I was collecting things that I thought were interesting about Madison and about Wisconsin, even though I never used the words Wisconsin and Madison.
I was going to say
in order
so
to
well.
Have some flexibility, because I play fast and loose with the geography. And if you get out a tape measure and measure the distances between cities, it doesn't work. So but I had to make up some fictional cities.
But do you have, say, you know, is there garlic growing and people are making artisanal?
Yes.
So the little farms
Yes. There's all that. Yeah. Which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Well, and Tassie's dad is a...
He's like a boutique farmer, and he's held in contempt by the other farmers.
Right.
Because the diehard, you know, family farmers that are in that, you know, in farming for generations would hold someone like Tassie's dad, who is the son of college, you know, a college professor.
Mm-hmm.
They would hold him in contempt.
And it seemed like they were really upset that he didn't paint his barn red, that he painted his barn blue, and somehow that seemed so outrageous to his neighbors.
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
And at the same time, though, I love, there's a point when Tassie actually, she's got an ambivalent, at the beginning of the book, she's ambivalent about her family, and in fact, I think she's more on the side of trying to kick them to the curb. She's really trying to get out in the world. She's on that cusp of adulthood, where you're leaving your childhood behind and you're figuring out who you are as an adult. You're trying on figures of speech and ways of being. And even, you know, she says things like, I started saying quasi a lot. That was my new word. And
yeah, well,
and she's kind of embarrassed by her family.
Right. I've written two novels from the... that are narrated or telling the experience of young women, and they both
are trying to shake loose their families, which I think is a typical, you know, situation for someone that age. Although, I have to say, young people nowadays, as you and I know, are much closer to their parents than we were.
Right, that's really
true. They are. And so they might not be. Although, I listen to my students, and they, you know, they have a lot of skepticism about their parents, but they love them, and they're very close to them.
Although, I don't know, I thought that was one of the things that I thought felt so right on, that Tassie really doesn't quite know what to do. You know, on one hand, she says she really likes her dad, and she likes his jokiness, and she's got a certain amount of pride in him, and yet she does really feel like she's a kid from the country, like suddenly gotten to the big world of sophistication, and she's definitely got she's got strong feelings about her mother.
Yeah, she finds her dad sort of harmless. She kind of likes him, but her mother somehow sticks in her craw for whatever reason. You know, mothers and daughters, it's all complicated.
Well,
her mother is also completely eccentric for that community.
Yeah.
She doesn't really belong there. She's just followed her husband into this farm life that probably isn't something she wanted for herself. And she can't see very well, which is a suggestion, of course, that she can't see her children very well either. So the children are not that close to the mother, and the mother is a little separated. I made sure to have a moment at the end of the novel of true maternal love, where Tassie's mother comes up to her and sort of rescues her and embraces her, because I felt that that's what any mother would do, even if it's someone as screwy as Tassie's mother.
Although I have to say, I loved Tassie. I just felt she rang so true, and I have a 22-year-old son, and know that sense of, you know, a kid leaving home and feeling like the world's opened up to him, and the push-pull of family. But, and maybe this is, because of where I am in my life, for your earlier books, when I read them through the first time, you know, there are quite a few sort of not very nice mothers.
Really? My mother is listening, because this is going to be broadcast. My mother does go through and, like, looks at all the mothers and goes, huh? You know? She's 83. She still does that. She's like,
Well, there's one of my favorite scenes, and I feel like it was sort of a typical mother scene. Of there's like just a tension between mothers and daughters, and there's a scene in the story Charades where the family has gathered for Christmas, and on Christmas Day, the grown-up children are playing charades with their parents, with their growing elderly parents. And at a certain point, the mother wins the game. She guesses the charade, whatever it was. And the daughter says, yes, and pumps her hand in the air and goes and kisses her mother on the cheek. And the mother says something like, or that you wrote something like, she knew that when she was young, she had been a mean mother. And so now that her children seem to have forgotten that, it was really satisfying. And I thought, yeah, actually, I really get that. Because, that's...
As a mother, you hope your children will forget all
that. It's a dirty job.
Yeah.
It really is.
But as you know, as we were talking in the car over, we don't forget did to us.
No, so. But you can. I do think there's a certain point when you become a mother yourself that you realize.
You both forgive and then don't forget.
Yeah.
You know,
well, there's that side where you think, how did you ever manage to keep me alive for the first 3 years of my life? Because I know I can't imagine how you did it. And then later, you also feel a certain understanding for how hard the job is.
Yeah, it's a hard job.
No, and so, in fact, how, I know there was this one line that I want to have tattooed on my arm that you said to someone about constructing a life in which writing is possible. But that's the job.
Yeah, well,
and
it's very hard.
So, like, what's the secret? Tell me. I need to know.
There is no secret. I'm still improvising. I'm just making it up as I go, because, as you know, just when you think you have it down, you know, your kid drops the morning nap, and so
right.
then you've got something down, but, you know, then the afternoon nap is gone. Then you have to, and soon they're in college, you know, and you're just like, what? What happened here? So everything changes, you know, that you have figure skating lessons or soccer, you know, games, you know, it changes every 2 or 3 years what you have to do.
Right.
And so it's really, you have to, I said to somebody once, I said, you have to, it's terrible, because this is what they say about really effective terrorist organizations, that they can improvise. And I say, you have to think like a terrorist. You have to improvise.
Yeah.
You know, if something comes up over here to block your way, you go another way. But I don't know. I used to sometimes get quite bitter and self-pitying, and I would say, you know, show me the mother who is also working and paying the bills and teaching her classes and keeping the house from falling down, and who is writing a novel that you really want to read. And then I would also wait for the silence and then add, and I'll show you Jane Smiley. But even Jane doesn't teach anymore.
Yeah.
Even Jane.
Well, so I remember Jane Ann Phillips once told me when
Jane Ann Phillips is
yeah,
another
Jane
one
Phillips.
That makes us look bad.
And but
so.
She told me when my kids were small, mm-hmm. she said, well, I said, I think it's going to be okay once kindergarten starts. And she looked
yeah.
at me sort of like, oh, you poor thing. And she said, well, it does get better when they learn to read, because then they can hang out by themselves and they can read and you can read and everyone, and you can write. And there's a certain autonomy. And she said, and you think it's going to be this beautiful trajectory forever. And then they turn into teenagers and suddenly they need you as much as they needed you when they were
right.
toddlers.
It all changes.
And
right.
it changes. And I found the same thing with a child going to college. I thought, you know, here's your hat. What's your hurry? Bye. And instead, he calls. We talk more.
Mm-hmm.
He called me today. We talk more
right.
now that
and
he's gone.
And they come home on vacations, and you still have to be there.
Not only do you have to be there, but they think that they're grown up. My son's first job, actually, I was thinking about this while reading A Gate at the Stairs, because his first job was being a babysitter, or as he called it, a manny.
A manny.
And
a manny. Oh, I get it. I'm so slow. A manny.
Yeah, a manny.
Okay.
And he came home from the first day of work, and he was like blue. He was so pale. And he had been taking care of this one-year-old baby all day long, and he staggered in. And I said, so Zachary, how was it? He said, oh, Mom, don't talk to me. And he immediately just turned on his video game thing and said, I've got to relax. You have no idea how hard it is to take care of a baby. That, yep, that's exactly it. But that, I think, is also part of what the incredible power of many of your stories, and this book in particular, is that sense of, as Tassie starts taking on this job of taking care of this little 2-year-old girl who she comes to absolutely adore, and the little girl calls her Tessa, and the sense of how important it is to take care of these little people, and how they are absorbing everything, and how important it is not only to them but to the mothers, to their fathers, to whoever is involved, that what an enormous responsibility it is to love anyone. And that seems to be really the heart of the book.
Yeah, I think what I was hoping for in this book, at least the character, Tassie, by the end of the book, is hoping that love can be made a useful thing. She goes into several different meditations on that idea, small ones, not long ones, but that love should be useful, that it shouldn't be about your feelings. It's got to be turned into something useful, otherwise it's no good.
I think even those two funny little, you know, throw-off jokes that Bo, her dad, tells her as they're driving, that's exactly what a useful love is, that in a moment when you both need comfort, you just give a little something to make it better for the other person. And I think I've read you saying, calling humor the little moments of generosity between people. And I think that's really, that sometimes is as good as it'll get.
Yeah, and I think that father character uses humor like that. I mean, very early on, that the son has a very bad report card, and it's got four F's and a D. And the father just stares at it and says to his son, "Looks like you're spending all your time on one course."
I love that.
That's the kind of dad he is. So,
I know, I just love that. I thought that was so beautiful. Well, I think we're actually out of time. I hate
this
because I feel like I could sit here and quote you back to yourself and laugh for hours. But instead, I think we'll share you with everyone else here. And we've got Lori's books are out in the lobby for purchase and signing if you'd like to do that. And say hello. And thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you for coming. And thank you, my dear.
You too.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.